towards trial, but the email communications don't lie. What they told us, it's just implausible that they were not vigorously interested in the software. And one final, another point to that, at the end of 2004, around November 2004, we were called back to D.C., where the Department of Homeland Security coordinated a meeting with the Department of Justice, and numerous agencies attended. FBI, Secret Service, Immigration and Customs, Border Patrol, U.S. Marshals, all these people were there. And at the end of that meeting, the gentleman, Stephen Cooper from the Department of Homeland Security, told us that the FBI liked your software.
Good evening, America. This is AJC Radio, where we bring the message of justice around the world. I'm Sam Thurman, along with Cliff Stewart, Lisa Stewart, and Lamont Banks. How's everyone doing?
Doing good.
That preview that you just heard was David Banks, one of the IRP six, one of the six men who is wrongfully convicted and currently sitting in federal prison in Florence, Colorado, for a crime that they did not commit, but they were accused of. And we want to invite you to go out to freetheirp6.org. Again, freetheirp6.org, and follow along as we talk about that story a little later on in the program. But we'd also like to invite you to tune in and or dial in if you have any questions or comments at 347-838-8976, 347-838-8976. And then also online, you can join us in the chat room. Chat room is open, and we'll take questions and comments there as well. Lisa, if you give us the disclaimer, please.
Okay, we just want to remind everyone that we had a just cause are not attorneys, and we do not provide any legal advice. You want to contact your own personal legal advisor for your legal needs. And we also want to let you know that what was the rest of it? I forgot.
Is your Red Bull working tonight?
It's not working. It's not working.
Well, we're not attorneys.
We're not attorneys. We don't provide legal advice.
There you go.
You do have to contact your own personal legal advisor. And
happy for you to be here.
Thanks for tuning in and choosing to spend time with us this evening, guys. I'm just waking up. Give me just a minute. I'll be good in just about 10 seconds, okay?
Hey, we want to remind you that the IRP6 are David Banks, Dave Zappolo, Kendrick Barnes, Clinton Stewart, Demetrius Harper, and Gary Walker. And again, we invite you to go out to freetheirp6.org. Again, freetheirp6.org, and prepare for what we're going to be talking about tonight, which will be unanswered questions and inconsistencies that led to the wrongful conviction of the IRP6. We're also going to cover a little bit of current news. And with that being said, and by the way, Cliff, welcome back to the seat. And glad to have you back in the studio, Lamont.
Yeah, definitely glad to have Cliff back. Good to have our colleague back, and we're a family around here, so you'll have to bear with us. And a lot of things going on in the news, and folks, again, whatever you got planned tonight and what's going on, this is, Sam, as you said earlier, going to be a very interruption. Well, wait a minute, we have an interruption. It looks like that. You know, we said before that there's a lot of news across the U.S., but Texas seems to be at the top of the list right now, and some things going on. Bear with us right now as we get ready for news in Texas. All right, folks. Sam, Lisa, Cliff, looks like they have an ex-probation officer out of Texas that looks like has gotten prison time for sex trafficking. And matter of fact, he was an ex-probation officer for juveniles. And that's kind of the example. It says here, a former juvenile probation officer in West Texas has been sentenced to 18 years in prison for his role in gang-related sex trafficking ring. Timothy Keith McCullough Jr. was sentenced Monday in federal court in El Paso, Texas. It says prosecutors say McCullough was among four men convicted in January of conspiracy to commit sex trafficking of persons. The other three were sentenced last week to prison terms ranging from 20 years to life behind bars. Says the testimony indicated the men in 2012 and 2013 forced children and adults into prostitution. Investigators say the men used force, fraud, coercion to force the victims into having sex for money, and the gang members kept the cash. And I think, Sam, what's troubling about that is the fact that we're talking about a probation officer in the juvenile judicial system. These are horrific charges and a horrific crime when you're dealing with kids and prostitution and all kind of things, which we talk about a lot, that the culture is that people can basically get away with anything, in this country if they had or have previously wore a badge.
Lamont, when people are in a position of trust, and that's what we're talking about here, they take advantage of situations, and then particularly in a situation like this, when you're talking about an ex-probation officer and the way he is caught up in this situation with kids. And, this is it's troubling. You know, when you hear about teachers, you hear about people who are caregivers who do this type of thing, you know, yeah, they should be going to prison.
Yeah, that's a bad situation. Cliff, your thoughts on that?
Yeah, what really gets to you is the fact that you look at the this man was a probation officer, and you say, well, what type of background check was done on him?
Sure.
What type of, how deep did they go into his background before they let him around underage children saying you're a probation officer? And for him to be able to circumvent the system and take these kids and, you know, basically force them into prostitution. How long could this have been going on before the authorities really got an eye on it? Who's his supervisor? Who's his boss that was watching over him? And, I mean, the article doesn't really say how long. I don't think it said how long he was running this ring. I mean, they got indicted or they got indicated in 2012 and 13. But, I mean, who knows how long this was going with kids being forced into prostitution. And I think the whole department that he was under, they should do a full, third-party audit to see what else is going on there. If you can have a prostitution ring going on.
Well, and, Cliff, it was more than just in Texas. I mean, it says here that the ring operated in El Paso, Killeen, New Mexico, Nevada, and Colorado. And he only got 18 years?
Wow.
I mean, that's a little bit. Matter of fact, it says the other people, 20 years to life behind bars. It raises the question that we go into as far as the sentencing disparities in this country. It's a double standard, if you will, in regards to our country. To me, it's really troubling. In 18 years for that type of thing, usually most crimes against children are excessively large to the point where this brings us to a point that I think is very troubling in this country.
Absolutely. And when you talk about the sentencing and that type of thing, and we've talked about it here on the program before, how people do not realize the impact that a wrongful conviction has on not only the person who is subjected to the time that they have to spend in prison, but then their families, their loved ones, their friends, knowing without a shadow of a doubt, that person is wrongfully convicted.
Yeah, and I mean, I couldn't have said it better than that, Sam. That's a troubling situation, and it goes back that we talked about before as far as the culture in this country. That's why we're here, and that's why we're here trying to get a message out across the country. This radio show is about getting that platform and standing on that platform, Lisa, Cliff, and Sam, that we might educate and bring information to people across the United States that this is why change is so desperately needed, and that's what we're pushing for, at least with this organization.
Absolutely. Lamont, let's move on to the next story here, which is right along that same line, and it's a very, very touching story, very disturbing, and talk about how wrongful convictions can impact families and impact an individual. This next story is really sad. It's a story of Glenn Ford. This gentleman, he spent 29 years in prison after a wrongful conviction. And he was released last year. Well, we were informed that he has passed away. He died from lung cancer at the age of 65. Now, you know, he spent 30 years, most of that time, in solitary confinement. So this is one of those tragic stories, again, where a person did not commit a crime, yet they spent basically so many terms, a lifetime in prison for something that he didn't do. And then he gets out, and then in a year, he dies. Now, the prosecutor who was involved in that case, he actually stepped forward. Now, this is totally, totally unusual. But A.M. Marty Stroud III, the prosecutor who helped convict Mr. Ford, says here that, and this is in the Huffington Post, that he penned an emotional op-ed in the Shreveport Times apologizing for his role in Ford's case. He's also calling for an end to the death penalty and admonishing the state to give Ford his due. And then Stroud goes on to say in this Huffington Post piece that we can't trust the government to fix the potholes. And he says, why should we believe they can design a death penalty system that's fair?
Wow.
So, I mean, when you listen to that, now, that's not gonna give Mr. Ford 30 years back of his life. But when you look at the footage online and look at the things that, you know, Mr. Ford's family is around him, and the thing is, I mean, when you look at the pictures of Mr. Ford walking out of prison, you see a man that's, you know, really, you know, pretty healthy, looks healthy, pretty big, and in his last hours, it was just a frail man that's sitting there and basically waiting to die.
Well, go ahead, Lisa.
I'm sorry. I'm just looking at this article. What just sickens me, just makes me sick to my stomach when I'm reading here, and it says that about a year after his release, that a district judge denied him restitution for his years of wrongful imprisonment, saying he was proven to be guilty of lesser crimes and was not an innocent man.
Wow.
Proven to be guilty of lesser crimes does not leave you deserving to spend your life in prison and come out sick and dying. That is ridiculous.
And the thing is, he was released. He was exonerated.
Yeah.
So for a judge to take that position, that's heartless. I mean,
that's completely,
go ahead, Cliff.
Heartless.
And what is the lesser crime? Did he steal a donut? You know, did he?
Well, in the last year, people have been killed for less.
Well, that's true. But I mean, how does a judge come out? You get so tired of the system that locks a person up for 30, 40 years and then comes out and says, yeah, we're sorry, but, you know, we're not doing anything about the fact that we took away your life because you got convicted of a lesser crime. What difference does that make? If you lock me up for a crime that I never committed, it was proven I never committed, then it doesn't matter what I did in the past. You shouldn't have had me locked up for that crime, and any person should be able to get restitution. That judge, these are the type of things that just makes you look at the American judicial system and say that, you know, the laws that are put in place that allow the judge to do that, those are the type of laws that need to be just destroyed, because a judge should not be allowed to make that type of decision. No, if you were wrongfully convicted, you're exonerated, you get restitution. That's the bottom line.
Well, and I'll say this, you know, our condolences to the family of Mr. Ford. What a tragedy to spend half of your life. It's difficult to be sick here when you're not incarcerated, let alone sick while you're locked up. We give our deepest condolences to his family. Especially that Mr. Ford was born in Shreveport on October 22nd, 1949. Ford was later raised by a grandmother in California, according to the Shreveport Times. Ford had several children, grandchildren, several of whom live in California and were able to visit him near the end of his life. Our condolences, our prayers go with the family as they deal with this grief and loss of a gentleman that lived a life of injustice by a system that has failed him. But what a tragic story again. But our thoughts and prayers are with the Ford family this evening.
And, you know, they just looking at the fact that this occurred at the same prison as the Angola 3. Now, he's not part of the Angola 3, but same circumstances as far as the amount of time that he was subjected to solitary confinement. And we already know of how the Angola 3, one of them, was released. And then the courts tried to put him back in prison, even though he had been cleared. I mean, they need an overhaul down there. And like the gentleman said, it takes advocacy. It takes people getting involved to bring about the change that we need. And so, again, rest in peace, Mr. Ford. Cliff, this story about this federal judge, Nancy Gertner. What do you think about this one?
This is, very troubling, but at the same time, very encouraging for the things that this judge, like you said, she's a federal judge. The headline of this story says, federal judge, my drug war sentences were unfair and disproportionate. That is the headline of the story, which, catches you right off the bat to say, okay, a federal judge made this statement. And then when you get into her story, it's even more compelling. This happened in Aspen, Colorado. As former federal judge Nancy Gertner was appointed to the federal bench by Bill Clinton in 1994. She presided over trials for 17 years. And Sunday, she stood before a crowd at the Aspen Ideas Festival to denounce most punishments that she herself imposed. Among 500 sanctions that she handed down, quote, 80%, I believe, were unfair and disproportionate, she said. I left the bench in 2011 to join the Harvard faculty to write about those stories, to write about how it came to pass that I was obliged to sentence people to terms that, frankly, made no sense under any philosophy. And this goes back to the mandatory minimum sentencing that basically are placed on certain types of defendants. You have the drug defendants, you have sexual offenders, and some of these mandatory minimum sentences are totally out of control. And here's a federal judge saying, yeah, the mandatory minimums, and that's not to say that, you know, there's a mandatory minimum. Some judges go totally crazy and say if you have to get a year, they'll give you 20. They're totally out of control.
Yeah.
This judge is saying that 500 sentences that she handed out in 17 years, that they were totally against what was anything fair or proportionate. And she's coming out herself to talk about it. And she, says that, or the article says she went on to savage the war on drugs at greater length. I mean, she really went out of her way to really go after this. Go ahead, Sam.
Yeah, I was just going to say, to hear this judge or to see some of the comments that she made, it's strange because you
right.
just I can't think of another word. You don't see this kind of thing where she says that this is a war that I saw destroy lives. And she says that it eliminated a generation of African-American men, covered our racism in ostensibly neutral guidelines and mandatory minimums, and created an intergenerational problem. And so, you know, when you see this kind of thing and you hear a judge that saw this, I guess, on a daily basis, I mean, 500 cases.
Right, and the most beautiful part about this article is the last sentence of it, where she says she's going on a specific project where she says she is trying to go through the list of all the people that she sentenced to see who deserves executive clemency. So for a federal judge to say, I did wrong, I don't appreciate the way that the system put me in a position where I had to lay down these sentences, but for a federal judge's voice to be on a clemency request for a person that she feels like should not be in prison, that goes a long way. I commend former Judge Nancy Gertner for the work that she's doing with this project.
And I think if you have a judge that's speaking on your behalf and saying that the system is broken, you know, I was operating within the system, but the system is broken, and for her to be writing about it and talking about it, You know, it makes you think about Judge H.B.
Yeah,
Sirica.
Absolutely.
You know,
does.
When you have someone who looks at a situation and says that, no, this is injustice. You know, Judge Sirica did it in the Hurricane Carter situation. He's been helping out tremendously in the IRP 6 case. And so, you know, as Judge Gertner, is going about and writing about these different types of cases, we're going to continue to follow that and stay on top of it. You know, one of the things that as we talk about disparity in sentencing and that type of thing, we're going to shift and get ready to go into our main theme of the evening as we talk about the IRP 6. And when you look at what happened in the IRP 6 case, you have to come to the conclusion that there are too many inconsistencies, too numerous to say that something was not wrong in this case. And, you know, a Just Cause has done an analysis of an ongoing analysis, I should say, of the IRP 6 case. And when you look at all these things on a timeline and see how, well, this event occurred, well, that shouldn't have happened like that. And then you couple that with something else, and then you couple it with something else, and then you couple that with something else. And it just builds a mound of a story that makes absolutely no sense. And, you know, I want to encourage folks to go out to www.a-justcause.com. Again, www.a-justcause.com. Or just do a Google search on IRP6 and a Just Cause. We put out a new press release this morning that talks about a little bit of that timeline. And so we're going to dive deep into that this evening. Lamont.
Well, ladies and gentlemen of America, if you're strapped in, we suggest you strap in a little tighter. What do you get, Lisa, Sam, and Cliff, with a pastor, a counselor of a church, six IT professionals, crooked judges, crooked prosecutors, a disorganized grand jury, a staffing company? What do you have? You have a little bit less than a Hollywood production. What do you call that? We call that the IRP 6 saga. When we come back, we're going to dig into that. Ladies and gentlemen, right now it is 8:20 on the East Coast in New York City. Down there in California, I believe it's 5:20 there. We're getting ready to dig into something that's going to make you go, Ladies and gentlemen, get ready to get started, because I tell you what, when we dig into this type of conspiracy, and it's nothing short of that. Who gets away with targeting innocent people in a place we call America? Lisa?
Yeah, just before we go to break, I just wanted to say the little part that my brain missed on when I was given the disclaimer was that the opinion expressed by callers and guests do not necessarily reflect that of a Just Cause. My brain totally blanked out on me. My Red Bull has kicked in now, so I am good to go.
Well, folks, there you have it. Charlisa has rebounded from a Red Bull after effect, if you will. We're coming back here, folks. It's summertime across the United States tonight. Maybe a little hot there on the East Coast, maybe a little humid. But guess what? We're just getting started. Grab some lemonade, perhaps some fruit cups. Bring over the dog in tonight off the porch. Let him get out the heat. Give him some air conditioning, if you will. But it's going to get hot here on AJC Radio. Stand by. The IRP 6, the unanswered questions that make you puzzle. We're puzzled tonight. We're getting ready to dig into it. Don't go nowhere. We'll be right back. Did you know that racial or ethnic minorities make up over 60% of people in U.S. prisons? According to the Sentencing Project, 1 in 3 black men and 1 in 6 Latino men will likely spend time in prison in their lifetime. Now, this type of disparity simply is not good for our communities. This type of disparity is not good for America. Now is the time for judicial reform. Now is the time to fix injustice in America. Won't you get involved today? Give us a call, won't you, at 1-855-529-4252. Time for talking is over, but time for action starts right now.
Can you imagine spending 20 years of your life in prison for a crime you didn't commit? Neither could I until I got the opportunity to portray Betty Ann Waters in the film Conviction, telling the real story of how she freed her brother Kenny. Sadly, what happened to Kenny happens far more often than you might expect. But together, we can stop it. Please join me in helping the Innocence Project fight injustice. Go to innocenceproject.org to make a donation and get involved.
Here are 50 white guys. Here are 50 black guys. Here's how many white guys can expect to go to prison in their lifetime. The chances amount to 1 out of 17. Now, here's how many black guys can expect the same thing. The chances are 1 out of 3. Why? Lots of reasons. It's complicated, but one thing is clear. There's a racial bias at every level of the criminal justice system. When blacks and whites commit the same kind of crimes, blacks are more likely to be arrested. Once arrested, they're more likely to be convicted. Once convicted, they're more likely to serve longer sentences. Look at the numbers in America's so-called war on drugs. About 14% of America's drug users are black, as are about a quarter of drug sellers. Yet blacks are 34% of people arrested for drug crimes. And those convicted of drug crimes, 46% are black. By the time we factor in sentencing, there are actually more black drug offenders than white ones in state prisons and federal prisons. In the end, the incarceration rate for drug crimes is 10 times higher for blacks than it is for whites. These are the facts. Racial disparities in America's war on drugs are one big reason that one of three black men can expect to go to prison in their lifetime.
KJC Radio, bringing the message of justice around the world. I'm Sam Thurman, along with Lamont Banks, Lisa Stewart, and Cliff Stewart. This evening, we're going to be talking about the unanswered questions that led to the wrongful conviction of the IRP 6. Our phone number this evening is 347-838-8976. 347-838-8976. Just as a reminder, the IRP 6 are David Banks, Dave Zerpolo, Kendrick Barnes, Clinton Stewart, Demetrius Harper, and Gary Walker. For more information about the IRP 6, go to freetheirp6.org. Again, freetheirp6.org. And that website has a lot of information out there that you will be interested in looking at, and you can just follow along with us. And as I indicated earlier, we put out a press release that talks about some of the timeline issues where some of these questions are raised and some of the issues that we'll be talking about with regard to the inconsistencies in this case. And by the way, you know, like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter. And, you know, Lamont, as we look into this case, and Cliff, the IRP 6 case and the chronology of events, there's some interesting twists in here that a lot of people may or may not know about. We've talked about it at one point or another, but, you know, what is one of the key things as far as, you know, targets of this investigation that led to the wrongful conviction of these six IT professionals who were developing this software for law enforcement?
Well, I'll tell you what, Sam, when you look at the events that happened, and we're going to go down here and speak to these issues, number one, we're going to go down here and why were the IRP 6 a target? Why were they such a interesting group of young men that got the attention of the federal government, that got the attention of a U.S. attorney, that got the attention of major people in corporate America? I'll tell you why they got that attention. They developed software that no one else could develop. They found answers to fight terrorists and keep America safe that no one else could produce. After millions of dollars was spent trying to find a solution, these six men in Colorado who they consider minority business because the six men all are African American, one Italian American. And why were they so important? Why were they such a point of interest?
Well, you know, Lamont, the software that they were developing was called the Case Investigative Lifecycle Software. And you got to go back a little bit in history and realize that the software was being developed right after the tragedy of 9/11. And so you had the 9/11 Commission, which identified the fact that law enforcement agencies had no way of sharing information or collaborating information. And so the software that the IRP6 were developing was right on time. It was real. It was not smoke and mirrors, and it was something that got the attention of the Department of Homeland Security at that time.
Well, Sam, Cliff, and Lisa, if you're ready, let me get my seatbelt on real quick because this is getting ready to get a little jerky, a little hot, if you will, and we're going to run down these events that have actually happened. Pastor Rose Bank, the number one target of the investigation, which absolutely, Sam, we said last week, things that don't make a lot of sense, that don't bring this concept, if you will, together. Pastor Rose Banks, a pastor in Colorado Springs, for going about 35 years, if I'm not mistaken, the target, a pastor above reproach, above any type of behavior, if you will, ethical behavior, none of those things. She's an innocent victim of this process.
And, you know, people might be interested to know, you know, well, why would you say that the pastor of a church is the target of this investigation? Cliff, I mean, what gives us the background to be able to definitively say that that is the situation?
Well, when you look at the things that happened during trial, so we say here on AJC Radio that, you know, don't take our word for it. Look in the trial transcript. And this particular piece of the file, the trial transcript, you have the grand jury foreman. I mean, this is the person who basically is presiding over the grand jury, making the decisions for them, you know, bringing back, indictment or not bringing back an indictment. When this person on the stand in open court was asked by the prosecutor, this prosecutor, Matthew Kirsch up in Denver, Colorado, under U.S. Attorney John Walsh, asked by the prosecutor, who was the target of the investigation? The foreman of the grand jury. This is not just some person who came to a conclusion on their own. This is the person who's running the grand jury, supposedly about the IRP Solutions investigation. This grand jury foreman says that the target of the investigation is Rose Banks, the pastor of Colorado Springs Fellowship. So that, when you have things like that, that is why we say, I mean, it's not our opinion, not something we came up with, not us compiling some list, some statements from people. This is what is in the court transcript. If you don't believe it, look it up. It's in the 10th Circuit Courts in Denver, Colorado. You will find that there.
All right, and what we're going to do, Sam, as we get ready to take off here, is go down this list of events that happened. They will be in brief, but they will give you an indication of how this puzzle came together. It's kind of like you're sitting at your kitchen table, you got a puzzle, you have a few pieces. When we're done here tonight, the pieces will be very clear, and that is a conspiracy and unanswered questions that make no sense that brought or was sought to bring the IRP6 down, Pastor Rose Banks, the Colorado Springs Fellowship Church members. And I can tell you one thing, ladies and gentlemen of America, they have failed, and we're going to educate you on that tonight. Okay, after Rose Banks being the target of the investigation, we have LaWanna Clark. Who is that, Sam, and why is she such a person of importance that speaks to that issue?
LaWanna Clark is the sister of David Banks, who is also the daughter of Pastor Rose Banks. Now, LaWanna was called in and used as a pawn, if you will. One of the court-appointed attorneys for one of the IRP6 even said, you know, came to the conclusion that, okay, someone was going to flip. And so it became readily apparent that Ms. Clark was being used to put pressure on the IRP6 in order to try and make them flip. Now, she was called to a grand jury, to the first grand jury that was presented with the IRP6 case. That was in 2007. She was hit with somewhere between 300 and 400 questions about the IRP situation.
Lisa, what happened? What was the next point on April 4th?
On April 4th, 2009, LaWanna Clark was indicted on a perjury charge in connection with her testimony during the 2007 IRP Solutions grand jury proceeding. She was asked between anywhere from 300 to 400 questions. The grand jury stated that they felt she committed perjury on three out of those questions, and they brought her up on perjury charges for those three answers that she gave.
Okay, and Cliff, what happened on November 12th, 2009? What happened then?
Then is when LaWanna Clark was convicted on one count of perjury. Now, Lisa said that there were 300 to 400 questions. They came back. The prosecutor said, well, three of those we believe you lied. The jury came back and said, we convict you on one count. And that was a lie. But then the sentence was 6 months in federal prison. Not parole, not probation, not a fine, but 6 months in federal prison with a person with no criminal record.
And let me tell you what's unusual about that, ladies and gentlemen. You don't go to prison on a perjury charge.
Nobody.
On one perjury charge. And here's the big thing, again, which creates the puzzle as the puzzle begins to come together. LaWanna Clark had no criminal history of any kind, and they targeted her as well. So we have the pastor, her daughter, and then the brothers, which we're going to get to now. Sam, what happened on December 21st?
Okay, on December 21st, 2009, Ms. Clark's attorney basically presented a motion to the judge requesting acquittal because of the fact that the conviction hinged upon a double negative question. She was presented with a question that said something to the effect that you never withdrew any money from the bank. I mean, you know, how do you answer that question?
Right.
And if you answer it one way, then a prosecutor, he could put the right spin on it and make a jury believe that, no, see, she lied right there.
Right.
But the fact is, she was absolutely telling the truth that she had nothing to do with what she was being accused of.
So even though asked for an acquittal, which in most courtrooms, you would think the acquittal would have been granted. Again, unusual behavior here. On January 6th, a certified forensic document examiner, Judith Housley, submits a letter of opinion for consideration by the court. The letter is not even considered. Note, Judith Housley's findings confirm that Ms. Clark did not commit perjury when she stated she did not withdraw funds from the business banking accounting. Housley's analysis confirms that Clark did not sign the withdrawal slip. Another confirmation that what the judge allowed here, the process here, ignored. They said the letter wasn't even considered. Again, another thing that doesn't happen when you got something that blatant, Cliff.
Exactly. When you have evidence that says, you know what, what the jury convicted me on, here is evidence. Yeah, blatant, not circumstantial, real evidence. The question was, did you sign this withdrawal slip? The answer was no. The jury did not believe that. The Judith Housley, the handwriting expert, came in saying with 20 years of experience working for the federal government, came in and said LaWanna Clark indeed did not sign this withdrawal slip. What you convicted her on is false, and she did not commit any crime. There was no perjury. She didn't sign it, and furthermore, it's her account, but she did not sign the slip, and the handwriting expert proved it. The judge, Christine Arguello, would not even consider bringing that
to
light.
Now, Lisa, Sam, how do you not consider the fact?
Exactly.
This is a factual issue, a professional of 30 years telling you this is not the case. There are people that go into courtrooms that have been locked up for years that come back with evidence saying this crime didn't happen and they are let go.
But you know what the worst part of that is, that the reason that Judge Arguello, you know, she didn't look at that. She denied the motion even for a new trial, saying that that evidence presented by the handwriting expert would not result in an acquittal.
Wow.
How does that make sense? How does the judge know what the thoughts of 12 jurors is going to be?
Well, Cliff and Sam and Lisa, that's why we're here. None of this makes sense, and that's what the people in America need to listen up. Lisa, what happened? Next.
Okay, once that was done, Judge Arguello denied a motion for release pending appeal.
What date was that?
That was in February 2010. She denied the motion for a new trial in January of 2010. In February, she denied the motion for release pending appeal, citing that an appeal does not raise substantial questions regarding whether a reasonable jury could have found her guilty on the issues of materiality. Then LaWanna Clark is set to report to federal prison to begin her six-month sentence after the conviction was affirmed by the 10th Circuit Court of Appeals on March 1st. She had to report to prison.
Unbelievable. Doesn't make sense. So you have all of these facts, all this evidence, Sam, that's just stacked up showing LaWanna Clark's innocence. Again, another thing that doesn't make sense here.
Right, because any reasonable person would say, this is the question, how does a judge look at evidence that proves that a person is innocent and yet sends that person to federal prison
for six months?
I mean, that's a simple question. How do you say there's evidence on the table that proves that you're innocent, but me as the judge, Christine Arguello, I'm sending you to prison? And what does she tell LaWanna Clark? I'm going to send a message that you don't lie to federal prosecutors. Well, I didn't lie. The handwriting expert proved that I didn't lie. Your vindictive vendetta as the judge is just to send me to prison. I'm going to make an example out of you. An example of what? That you as a judge send innocent people to prison?
And that you ignore evidence.
You ignore evidence.
An example? Unbelievable, Sam. What happened next?
So if we go and look at how all this ties together, you know, the IRP 6 case is sitting right at the foundation of this. It's showing that the federal government and the prosecutors involved in this case, Matthew Kirst and Sunita Hazra, would go to any length to get a conviction and to send six men to prison, even if I have to send an innocent woman to prison first.
Well, it looks like, Sam, if I'm not mistaken, it looks like the groundwork was set here on the events we just read. The Pastor Rose Banks, the church members, then the daughter of Rose Banks, the son of Rose Banks. Did you hear what I hear? Then this ain't a Christmas carol, ladies and gentlemen. This is reality about a judicial problem that is going on here. This is a set conspiracy. The IRP 6, the six innocent men now. Now the story thickens. The plot thickens down, Lisa. On January 18, 2005, what happened?
On January 18, 2005, FBI Special Agent John Smith, he received a sworn statement from one of the FBI agents, one of the former FBI agents that was working at IRP Solutions. When he was looking for some reason to bring a criminal charge, he received a sworn affidavit from this former agent saying that IRP Solutions truly had a viable law enforcement product and appeared to be moving forward to acquire state, federal, and federal law enforcement contracts for their product. So this is before anything else happened. He gets this affidavit from this man who's working inside IRP Solutions with the IRP Solutions team to customize their product. He says, yes, this is a viable product. They're working. They're moving forward toward making a sale.
That's unbelievable. What happened next, Lisa?
Then very shortly after that, February 9th, 2005, the FBI raids IRP. Special Agent John Smith was the lead investigator, and this was very shortly after he received that sworn statement from Gary Hilberry.
And when you look at the you know, basically what was laid out, the contents of the search warrant, how it was laid out, what was said, what Agent John Smith had to come up with to get a judge to sign off on a warrant. You think back to what Lisa just spoke about, Gary Hilberry, the retired federal agent who was working as a subject matter expert at IRP Solutions. And he gave a statement to John Smith saying that the software is real. I'm helping them work on it. The first order in the search warrant says that IRP Solutions was a purported software development company. That word purported means they're pretending, they're acting, they're supposed to be building software, but in essence they're not. This is after he gets a sworn affidavit from a federal agent saying, yes, they're working on the software, I've seen it, and it's viable for local, state, and federal government. The FBI comes in. They don't just go after the financial records that they claim between IRP Solution and these staffing companies. They seize company intellectual property, meaning the way that the software was laid out, different type of patent applications and things of that nature. They take software code, patents, engineering notebooks. They take personal properties, all these things that had nothing to do with the warrant. The warrant specified financial records between IRP Solutions and the staffing companies they were using to augment their staff to help to develop the software.
And if I'm not mistaken, when a law enforcement agency conducts a raid, they have very strict bounds that they have to stay within when it comes to what a warrant says.
Yeah, and that when we went up after this raid and sometime a few months after all this had happened and spoke to the lead counsel for the FBI, that lead counsel, I was there in the room. He said that anything that was collected outside of what was laid out in that search warrant, anything that was collected outside of that makes the entire search warrant illegal, and you basically, that is grounds for the entire investigation, the case, and everything to be dropped, and for the FBI to be brought under suit. Of course, when this was brought to the attention of Judge Christine Arguello, she basically ignored that, just like she ignored the evidence in LaWanna Clark's case.
That's unbelievable, and as you see here, Cliff, that it seems like there's a different agenda going on here. That there's, what is the motivation here? Are there big, there's outside influences here that I think is going on, that is, because again, when you begin to lay down everything that's happened, Cliff, what you just said a moment ago, they're going in, they're talking about purported, you know, these people are aware that this software is legitimate. They are aware that this thing, now you know what the tragic part, Sam, Lisa, Cliff, is this. If you know this is something that can help America, how far does a conspiracy run to even not even regard the safety of a country and a nation?
Well, it runs as far as the next dollar to the large of the large corporations. If they got $1 billion, that's how far the live runs.
Well, some other folks had some comments on this in regards to what's going on. Let's see what they had to say.
This case just has so many peculiar and unbelievable little twists and turns to it that you'd almost have to say there has to be some kind of outside influence or motivation for why these guys were prosecuted, why they got what I consider to be outrageous prison terms, and why. By all accounts, and I've got all the documentation, I've looked through it, by all accounts, the software program that they had developed was an enormously successful, or could be an enormously successful tool for law enforcement. So it's almost like law enforcement cannibalized themselves on this case. And you have to wonder, what was the motivation? Who was driving this?
Well, it sounds like, Sam, to me, this is Mark Garagos, a gentleman that was called in as an attorney on the case when he was first notified in regards to the actions. He is saying there has to be an outside motivation here that is causing these people to go to this length. Again, those are the things that we're saying tonight that simply does not make any sense. Sam, as you hear that, he seems very confident that something else and really sick is going on here. Your thoughts?
When you look at the situation with all of the companies who had failed at trying to deliver something for the federal government, Cliff, what we had, the virtual case file situation that failed. You had the Sentinel project that failed. And so it's hundreds of millions of dollars. It was actually right around $1 billion.
Yeah, a little bit over $1 billion.
That actually was just totally wasted on solutions that did not work. Now comes along IRP Solutions, and you have something that really works. The government recognizes it. So do other people, because the government was actually pointing other people to IRP and saying that, you know, we have a company that has developed something and it fits for what we're looking for as far as the Federal Information Case Management System. And if you want to get a piece of this pie, you need to team up with IRP Solutions.
Well, here's what's crazy, Sam, to me, is that, you know, you ever been in a mall and somebody said a bomb is in the building and everybody scattered and everybody started running and everybody was in a panic and out of control? This gives me the indication that when IRP 6 was on the map and it was told that these men in Colorado, a little place called Colorado Springs, they've done something down here that will change a nation and a world. So you have all of these big people out here, these big corporations out here that say, well, man, we want credit for it. You got government agencies out here saying, well, we don't know if this is something that another person may or may not get credit for. Lisa, what happened next here? It looks like to me that Department of Homeland Security comes into this maze. What happened?
Yes. In February 2005, IRP attempted to contact the Department of Homeland Security, the contacts that they have been speaking with. And IRP was told that DHS had been informed that IRP was the subject of an investigation and that they were, quote, to not do business with IRP Solutions.
Now, prior to that, though, Lisa, if I'm not mistaken, they had gone to Washington, D.C. and done a demo.
They had gone to Washington, D.C. and done multiple demos.
Now, my understanding was they called it the vegetable soup of law enforcement in this meeting. Is that correct?
Absolutely. Sam, you know who all was there.
Yeah, in this meeting, you had the FBI, you had the TSA, you had the Federal Air Marshals, you had Secret Service, you had Immigration and Customs Enforcement. You had agents, every law enforcement agency that falls under the umbrella of the now the Department of Homeland Security or Department of Justice, literally almost every law enforcement agency was there because each one of these agencies have a role to play in the protection of our nation, especially when you're looking at the terrorist activity.
Well, folks, you'll have to pardon me. My seatbelt got a little tight. It's not the vegetable soup of law enforcement. It would be the alphabet soup of law enforcement. Ladies and gentlemen, the point being made is that everybody that played an interest in this situation was people of major importance. We're talking about people, as Cliff, Sam, the highest level of security of the United States of America.
Absolutely. And just to make a point real quick before you go forward, Sam, when you look at the fact that DHS says, hey, the FBI is telling us don't do any business, don't have any contact with IRP Solutions, when after the raid, one of the companies sent a letter to the FBI saying, hey, you know, this and that about IRP Solutions. You know, I went into business with them, whatever, whatever. The FBI responds to them. The FBI Special Supervisory Agent, this is Gene Anderson up in Denver, Colorado, sent a correspondent to one of these vendors stating, quote, we, the FBI, are unable to assist you in this matter and therefore no investigation will be conducted by the Federal Bureau of Investigation. However, the FBI has made it a matter of record. We feel this case would best be handled civilly and have noted that you have initiated legal action against the company. When you look at this, that the FBI is basically sending a letter back saying this is a civil case. There's nothing we can do. The FBI basically is not in the business of debt collection. Go deal with it civilly. That's what we recommend that you do. And by the way, we're not going to take any action. And then for them to tell Department of Homeland Security, don't have any business with IRP Solutions. These are the type of things that you say, how do you come up with these type of statements? And when we on AJC Radio says that there had to be some type of conspiracy that was going on, these are the facts that make us believe that, that say these things happened. There was no reason for them to happen. The people in authority, like the FBI, says, there's no reason for us to go into any type of federal investigation. This is a civil matter. Then for them to pursue that, for all these things to happen, that is why we say that these are the unanswered questions. These are the questions that beg to be answered by the public, that if this could happen to a small business like this, what about your small business? What about your mother, your father, your sister that has done nothing to go to federal prison? But like LaWanna Clark ends up spending 6 months in federal prison for no particular reason at all.
And I just wanted to go back to one thing that we were talking about when we were talking about the demos that were being done in Washington, D.C. And there were people in that meeting also who, after the fact, we found out that, you know, they were kind of like the technologists, so to speak, as far as part of the Department of Homeland Security. And there were comments that were made that something to the effect that, hey, if this guy liked what he saw and you were able to answer all of his questions, then, you really have something. And then particularly after one of the demos, folks from the Department of Homeland Security came out after the demo and expressed the fact that the FBI and other agencies that were in the room, the comment was made that they really liked what they saw.
Ladies and gentlemen, I don't know what's going on in your part of the United States of America tonight, but I tell you what, it's getting hot on here. I'm going to tell you, we have to cool off in here. If I'm not mistaken, Sam, if we don't take a break, the fire sprinklers are going to go off because this is just getting started here. Folks, if you got some sprinklers where you at, you may want to run outside and run through them because guess what? It's getting ready to get a little bit hotter. This is AJC Radio, where we bring the message of justice around the world. What are we talking about tonight? The IRP 6, the conspiracy, the cover-up of six men that are in federal prison. We're fighting for justice, and we do it right here on AJC Radio. Hang on. We'll be right back.
The racial composition of the prison population in the United States is very different from the population at large. If people are worried about inequality in America today, I think this deserves more attention in the discussion. Racial inequality in the criminal justice system gets ignored because it doesn't affect most people. In 2010, over 1.6 million people were in state and federal prisons within the United States. So, 497 out of every 100,000 Americans were in jail. About half of 1%. Less than 1%. That doesn't seem very large, but when you separate that population by race, you recognize that the personal effects of the criminal justice system are very unequally shared throughout our society. Whites make up 64% of the total population, but only 31% of the incarcerated population. Blacks represent 14% of society, but 36% of the prison population. Hispanics are 16% of America, but 24% of the American prison population. Less than 1 in 100 Americans are currently in jail, but for some races, genders, and age groups, that ratio is a lot larger. For example, if you're young, black, and male, it's closer to about 1 in 4. That means you'd have a higher probability of going to jail than of getting married or going to college. These results are unequal and problematic, as poor black communities lack so many of their members. But what can be done? The causes of this trend are undoubtedly complicated and multi-causal. But there is reason to suggest that part of the blame is our criminal justice system itself. In the ways police officers enforce laws, in the ways that laws are written and prosecuted, and more. In many cases, it is not overt racism by individual actors. Many police officers, prosecutors, and judges are undoubtedly trying to be fair and trying to do the right thing. But economics can explain how unequal enforcement of the criminal law happens anyway. This is because the political and bureaucratic structure of the criminal justice system creates perverse incentives. The formal laws surrounding drug prohibition, for example, are written as if to be colorblind. But people with different levels of wealth face different costs and benefits to participating in the drug trade. Different groups consume different drugs at different rates, and lastly, those groups are politically represented in very different quantities. Thus, they are arrested and incarcerated at very different rates. How could minority groups hope to use the political process to fix inequality when they are systematically over-incarcerated and disenfranchised? Despite noble intentions, politics often does not affect the basic incentives of costs and benefits faced by political or citizen actors. We might need a new approach to social change if we are going to address these problems. We definitely need more study into the causes of inequality, and we should admit that radical changes might be both necessary and preferable to the status quo.
The way just the FBI raid was conducted, many of the questions that were asked were completely inappropriate. And overall, I felt a feeling of betrayal. We had worked so hard, so long, through blood, sweat, tears, that we had given towards developing a comprehensive, consolidated case management solution that would truly help the federal government. We had been to the Department of Homeland Security. We had been to the New York City Police Department, both of which had yielded just much fruit from an interest perspective in the software solution. Even coming up to a point where three quotes were requested by the Department of Homeland Security, and the final one for $70 million to be put into the 2005 DHS budget.
This evening, ladies and gentlemen, we're talking about the unanswered questions that led to the wrongful conviction of the IRP-6. And, you know, this is one of those stories that everyone who has seen just bits and pieces of the story or heard bits and pieces of the story, they say, man, this sounds like a book. This sounds like a movie. But it is not fiction. It is not a book. It is not a movie. This is all factual. The disturbing part, though, is that it happened in the United States of America. And it happened to six men who are trying to help the country prevent another tragedy like what occurred on 9/11. So let's continue with our timeline, and let's jump in here where, you know, we've talked about all the things that occurred during some of the early years in the case. In December of 2006, the federal government actually added an extra twist in here. And so, Lisa, what are we looking at there?
Yeah, these people, the FBI, started targeting members of the church at their homes and at their jobs. They started going to their places of employment, started going to their homes, and also began pulling their bank records and different things like that, trying to prove in some way that that IRP Solutions was trying to launder money through the church. There was never any evidence to substantiate any of that. They never came up with anything, but that's what their purpose was. But going to these members' homes, going to their jobs, trying to get them fired off their jobs. I mean, they just began harassing the members of Colorado Springs Fellowship Church to no end.
So when they got these banking records, how did they get them? I mean, how did folks find out that even happened?
That was revealed during discovery of the IRP-6 case. When they started going through the discovery and found out there were, I believe it was thousands, wasn't it, Cliff, of pages?
Yeah, it was over 9,000 pages of banking records.
And these are not the IRP-6 banking records. These are banking records of church members, church pastor, and the church itself, where they're pulling their bank records without any legal backing to do so.
No subpoenas.
None. Wow. So, but all along, the IRP-6 and the executives who were the executives of IRP Solutions continue to try and service the law enforcement agencies of this nation to present them with a solution that would help them in their fight against whether it be terrorist activity or just, you know, the regular criminal activity that's going on in their city. There was something particularly that happened in the early part of 2009, the January 2009 time frame. Lamont, what happened there?
It looks like on January 2009, is it Lorelle Larson, chief investigator of Philadelphia Office of the Inspector General, contacted banks via email stating that they were excited to do business with IRP Solutions. Now, if this is the Inspector General's Office of Philadelphia, they're calling saying, we like what you have. Again, going totally against this absurd claim by the prosecution that this is some fake company out here doing nothing.
Absolutely.
And look, Mon, when you talk about the interaction between Philadelphia and IRP Solutions, you're talking about this is not just they got a PowerPoint spreadsheet and said, oh, we want to buy the software. This was just like at DHS. The OIG's office in Philadelphia said, this is what we need. IRP Solutions responded with, here is what we have. When the customizations were made for the IG's office of Philadelphia, that's why Lorelle Larson came back and said, you know what, we're excited to do business with IRP Solutions because the other vendors that we have been using have not been able to deliver. You're talking about what IBM and Motorola were there for, I think, like 7 years, had gotten almost $10 million for one particular model to make an electronic search warrant. And they could not make it. IRP Solutions comes in, said, what do you want the search warrant to look like?
This is what we need. They've been trying for 10 years. 3 months later, IRP Solutions says, here it is. Not here's a picture of what we might be able to do. Here is the customized software finished. That's why she said,
wow,
we're excited to do business.
And you know what, Cliff? The IRP Solutions software, the case investigative lifecycle software, and the things that David Banks and Gary Walker were presenting to the city of Philadelphia, it was so on point.
Yes.
That the deputy mayor for public safety made a comment to Mr. Banks and stated that if he didn't know better, he would have thought that David was in his office when he was talking to his public safety folks about what they needed for the city of Philadelphia.
And that is because that is how IRP Solutions does business. You give IRP a set of requirements that you say you need these customizations, IRP comes back. And here is exactly what you asked
for. Well, the old saying says the proof is in the pudding, and the proof was in it. Lisa, what else? It didn't stop there, Lisa. What else happened after that in the state, in the city of Philadelphia?
Yeah. So we have Gary Cardenas, who's the director of information technology for the PPD, which is the Philadelphia Police Department. He's interviewed by FBI agent Jennifer. I cannot even be. I have no idea how to pronounce her last name. No.
Inyo.
Okay, Inyo. Okay. Regarding the IRP Solutions case, and what they were quoted as saying is that they were very close to having the product installed prior to the discovery of the IRP investigation.
Are you kidding me right now?
They're right at the point where they're ready to go ahead and have it installed. Then they're told these people are under investigation.
And then when you look
Who made that statement, Cliff?
It's not just the investigation, because all of these companies, every company understand that when you're in business, you come under investigation sometimes. That's not the problem. The issue came about when the city of Philadelphia was on the verge of the purchase and the install of the software when assistant U.S. attorney, yes, Matthew Kirsch, told the Philly Inspector General, Amy Curlin is her name, that IRP was soon to be indicted. See, it's not the investigation that's the issue. It's when a federal assistant U.S. attorney comes in and says, these people are about to be indicted. How do you know they're about to be indicted? The grand jury had not even been impaneled.
Well, it sounds like to me, Sam, Lisa, Cliff, the ADA, the U.S. state attorney, is that correct, Cliff?
Yeah, the U.S. attorney, Kirsch.
Kirsch undermined the existing system of justice and due process. That, number one, they were not convicted of anything.
They weren't even charged
with anything.
Yep.
And you have a assistant attorney, U.S. attorney, goes outside of his role to make sure that the business is stopped.
That is what is called interference with commerce, and it is a federal crime. Right. You cannot do that, and the outcome of that is that the city of Philadelphia canceled both of IRP's engagements with the Philadelphia PD and the Philadelphia Inspector General's office after this conversation with Matthew Kirsch, assistant U.S. attorney.
Well, folks, if you can paint a picture in your mind, you have a technician in a building installing something. He has his tool belt out. He's in the server room making sure the business will operate, and somebody comes in and snatches his belt from him and said, get out of our building. That's what happened to the IRP 6. They said they were close, Lisa, to installing the software.
Absolutely.
And we have a U.S. attorney that comes in to block the safety of a city, ultimately the safety of a nation, Sam.
Well, when you look at this as well, this is the second time that an agency was told not to do business with them. So, you know, if you go back to what we were talking about earlier, Department of Homeland Security was told not to do business with them. And so it points to the integrity and the moral standing of the IRP executives. I mean, IRP being a startup company, what startup company does not have debt? IRP Solutions being a company that has debt and was dead set on settling up that debt. So IRP Solutions executives went about continuing to conduct business. But when you have someone that continually blocks them from doing business, it essentially stifled them from being able to produce revenue, which would allow them to settle up the debt.
Right, which also basically is a self-fulfilling prophecy.
Absolutely.
For the prosecutor's case. Because he said, if I can keep interfering with your business, then you can't pay your debt, then I can make the claim that you never intended to pay your debt. Well, if each time I go to make a sale and I have a customer ready to sign on the dotted line and you show up and say, no, 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 don't do business, they're about to be indicted, you scare off all my customers and then say, you never intended on paying anybody. Those are the type of things that make this case so sickening. And yeah, we see a conspiracy, but it is not on the part of the IRP-6. It's on
not even close.
It's on the part of the U.S. government,
but
here, Cliff, in the 10th Circuit.
And you know what else? What hits me is that when he goes in and he tells these people that the IRP was soon to be indicted, this is 3 months prior to an indictment coming out.
Prior to even the grand jury being impaneled. I mean, the grand jury has not even got together to say, hey, let's look at the evidence.
Well, let's ask a question, Lisa, Cliff, and Sam right now. Hypothetically, in that 3 months when the installation in Philadelphia was taking place or getting ready to take place,
mm-hmm.
let's just go there in our minds as ISIS sits on the horizon in America, cells are sleeping here all across the country. What happens, and what happens to these conspirators? Had some type of attack that the IRP-6 software could have avoided in the city of Philadelphia. What happens then? Who's liable then? America, this is the question that has to be asked. These actions, in this case, did not result in a terrorist attack on the country that was missed. But if this action is happening by government officials in Philadelphia, it's happening in Colorado, it's happening in New Jersey, it's happening in New York, wherever these cells are, this is why this has to be told. Lisa, what happened next?
Well, you know, I mentioned earlier that about the church being harassed and the bank records being seized and being looked at without authorization. One thing I wanted to mention in regard to that was that when the assistant U.S. attorney Matthew Kirsch was asked in open court in regards to their ability to be able to get these, did they have subpoenas? What was we wanted to see the subpoenas because you're supposed to have a subpoena to pull bank records. The assistant U.S. attorney made the statement in court that even if he did obtain those records illegally or improperly, that wasn't relevant to the case. So if I broke the law, that really has nothing to do with the case. That has everything to do with the case. If you obtained anything that you obtained illegally, you know you're not allowed to bring that into a court of law.
And Lisa, I believe you even went as far as to say that if we have to reveal how we came about these records, then we're going to be on a slippery slope.
Yeah.
Is this not a country that we have protections under the Constitution?
We're
supposed to.
Sam.
Man.
This is absolutely unbelievable. I tell you what, this is it sounds to me like a firestorm that happened here. And not only did it leave everybody in confusion, down to going back again to the raid, what happened after the raid happened, and then you got the church. This is like a movie that has to take years to create. But
well,
it
did.
And this is what it did. This was a creation.
One of the things that we had planned to do in our trial was to bring on a staffing expert who had, I believe, 30 years of experience in the staffing company in the staffing industry to tell them what the normal operations were for staffing. He was a cornerstone of our defense. And the judge did not allow him to testify on our behalf as an expert. That's one of our points of appeal, because there's no reason that person should not have been allowed to testify on our behalf as an expert.
So it seems to me, Sam, as you hear that the... you know, Gary Walker, CEO of IRP Solutions, baffled with what took place. Can you imagine these men, again, sitting in an office and all of a sudden these actions, as we built this conspiracy, you'd have to be delusion. You have to be really taken back here by what you see, because it sounds like a rushing storm that hit out of control in a sudden period of time, though it took years for them to create these lies and what they have come down to do. To me, it seems unreal. You ever seen movies that you've watched that just doesn't seem to be a real situation? To me, this is what this gives it, Lisa. This gives it a little bit of, it does not seem real, especially here in the United States.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's something that is the strangest. I mean, how does a person sit here and you're looking around like, man, what is going on? And you know what? They keep on doing what they're doing, Lisa, as you said, targeting the church, doing the things, going after their pastor, after their church members, harassing them, threatening them about jobs, all these things that are going on. To me, this is the mystery. Cliff, Lisa, Sam?
Well, the thing is, you know, when you look at all these things that happen, the part, okay, they happen. They shouldn't happen, these prosecutors, the entire justice system. This shouldn't be the way that it's working. When the judge gets involved, won't intervene, won't ensure justice is being handed out, won't ensure that, basically due process is being laid out. The judge, Judge Christine Arguello, did nothing that had anything to do with justice. All she did was block justice every step along the way. Everything that was brought up about what Assistant U.S. Attorney Matthew Kirsch was done, she didn't allow the fact that that the subpoenas didn't exist. She's like, well, we'll take that under consideration. To this day, it hasn't been considered. No. She didn't do anything to ensure that any type of justice was met out for these for IRP solutions, the IRP 6. This is totally sickening.
And you know, Cliff, when we look at the continuing with the timeline. And talk about, okay, we've talked about how Kirsch wanted to block how they came about the subpoenas.
Right.
Well, then also in May 2009, the, quote, long-awaited, the yet-to-come indictment did come. Now, I want our listeners to recognize that this is the second grand jury, the first grand jury in this situation where they had several witnesses. A lot of people were called. That grand jury came back and said, hey, this is a debt collection case. Now, this is the second grand jury. Took 2 years. It's 2 years later, if I'm not mistaken, that the second grand jury occurred. There was only one witness call. That was an FBI agent by the name of Robert Mullen. And he put the right spin on the story. That grand jury returned an indictment. That right spin did not include the correct spin. It was not an accurate spin. It did not have factual information that was presented, but the grand jury came back with an indictment.
And when you look at the grand jury process, they say that 99% of all cases presented to the grand jury result in an indictment. Well, the first grand jury came back and said, you know what, this is one of those cases that no indictment needs to come. This is a civil matter. We are not going to let you. And like you said, Sam, when they were allowed to hear witnesses, and evidence was put before them, they basically told the prosecutor, we are not going to let you basically criminalize debt. Because if we let you criminalize debt in this situation, then you can come after me for debt. Well, that is when the grand jury was given everything. And the second grand jury, when only one FBI agent was there testifying, telling all the lies that he wanted, spinning the story in the way that Kirsch wanted to be spun, that is when they came back with an indictment. That's why they say that you can indict a ham sandwich, because the prosecutor can lie all they want and they have blanket immunity as long as they're so-called doing their job while they're telling all the lies and all but breaking your neck in court.
Well, at this point, it's a firestorm of confusion, because you have these men believing and knowing that they are innocent. They haven't committed a crime. Now they've been indicted. We started to reach out. The IRP 6 started to fight and search for justice.
What happened, Lisa?
Well, a letter was sent out to our Senator Mark Udall, as well as the Department of Justice, the Office of Professional Responsibility, looking for them to do some kind of investigation as to how it is that the FBI, the way the FBI handled this entire case, about the way they went into the church members' records, the church bank records without subpoena, how they were all the crooked things that they did, all the wrong things that they did in dealing with this case, and we received no response, no action was taken, no response was even received.
And then shortly after that, Lisa, looks like 4 months maybe later, Sam, something happened on September 30th. As again, the questions, the search for answers. Was being done here. What happened, Sam?
Well, it goes back to the thing that all the way back to the beginning of the story when the FBI search warrant said that IRP Solutions was a purported software development company. So now you begin to see that the story starts to shift. It starts to morph. And so there's concrete evidence all throughout between that time and 2005. For 5 years, IRP Solutions has proven that this is a legitimate company, this is a legitimate product, and we do have something that law enforcement needs. That was validated by Cala Forensics, which is a software forensics firm, and Don Vilfer, who was part of the Cala Forensics firm, confirmed that the Silk software was not vaporware, and it included large amounts of complex coding that required significant software development. And then he went on to say that the Silk software was functional and that it was also had many notable features, and it was a functional product that was work for its intended customers, being law enforcement agencies at the state, federal, and local level.
Okay, well, I'll tell you this. At this point, the IRP6 begin to wonder where their defense counsel is. They're looking, okay, now we must go to court. We have crossed the areas where we've crossed. Now this is a new area. Now we must fight for justice here. We must begin to tell our story and let our voices be heard. And surely we'll have some attorneys here that will represent us diligently and execute justice on our behalf. And it looks like here on December 13th, 2010, Judge Arguello issues order regarding motion to dismiss counsel and to proceed pro se. Judge Arguello's order is in response to requests from the IRP executives to dismiss their court-appointed attorneys. The reason for that is, in a year and a half, if I'm not mistaken, Lisa, correct me if I'm wrong, folks, that nothing was done by these attorneys. Nothing was done. No evidence, no discovery. Nothing was reviewed or looked at for these men's behalf. There was no effective counsel here. Lisa, what happened next?
Well, they had a hearing before the U.S. Magistrate Judge, and they were granted the option to go pro se and to fire their attorneys, which they did, and they moved forward without them.
Okay,
because these attorneys, like you said, they did nothing all that time. They refused to attend meetings with them when they had the opportunity to meet with the U.S. the state attorney. They refused to go in with them, and so they finally were able to go ahead and get rid of those attorneys and represent themselves pro se.
And, you know, one thing that led to that, Lisa, also was the fact that the IRP6, they wanted to convey to the U.S. Attorney's Office that, hey, here's what we did, here's why we did it, here's how we did it. They put together a proffer, and they asked the court-appointed attorneys at the time to set up a meeting, go to that meeting with us. Those court-appointed attorneys did not want to go to a meeting with them, and so the IRP6, in the March time frame of 2011, they ended up submitting a proffer to the U.S. Attorney's Office outlining, hey, here's what we did. And it was very factual. One of the things that's key here is the fact that they had to sign a document for the U.S. Attorney's Office saying that if we are lying anywhere in this proffer, then we understand that we could be subjected to prosecution for lying in the proffer. There was no such claim to come back to say, hey, you know, what you presented in this proffer is not true. But the U.S. Attorney's Office did not move forward on what was presented there. But if you go out there and look at the proffer that the IRP executives presented, it'll show the story. It'll show what they did, how they did it, and it was consistent with the industry standards.
So it sounds like the IRP, well, it is, not sounds like, this is what it is, ladies and gentlemen. The IRP6 did everything they could do to let these people know this is not what happened here. This is not what is being portrayed is not what the truth is. And they began to seek justice, to submit a proffer, Sam, as you've stated, told that there would be penalty of perjury if for any reason any of that information is false. It doesn't stand to reason that these men, ladies and gentlemen, are you hearing what we're hearing in this studio tonight? It does not stand to reason that these men are criminals. They were a target by the federal government. Let's move towards the trial. Cliff, what happened next in this timeline?
Well, next in this timeline, you have Andrew Alvarelli, who was slated to be an expert witness in the IRP6 trial. And just to jump ahead a little bit into the trial, Judge Christine Arguello pulled Andrew Alvarelli off the stand as he was being introduced by the defense. Now, there's all kind of issues with that, but for this point, Andrew Alvarelli sends a letter to the U.S. Attorney's Office, to John Walsh's office, saying in his expert opinion, and he's got about 20 years in the staffing industry, saying that what IRP Solutions did in business with these staffing companies was the way that business is done when it comes to staffing. There was no hidden agenda. There was no type of conspiracy, no type of fraud going on. This is how business is done in the staffing industry. And obviously, the Assistant U.S. Attorney Matthew Kirsch and the others who brought this case forward had no clue about how the staffing industry works. And Andrew Alberelli's letter laid that out. Also, Kelly Balcom, who is also a expert in the staffing industry. She's been an account manager for almost 20 years herself. She laid out the same type of letter saying, hey, what happened here is what happens in staffing. You go into business with a staffing company. This is the risk that the staffing companies take. And the bottom line is if something happens and you know you owe the staffing company money, you can go into a civil action. And also the staffing companies, you know, just like any other corporation, can write off their loss at the end of the year. So for this to be misconstrued as fraud and wire fraud and mail fraud and conspiracy is the furthest thing from the truth.
Lisa, what happened next?
Well, September 26, 2011, they begin their trial. The IRP-6 goes to trial for the charges that were brought against them that were trumped up, but they begin their trial September 26, 2011.
And, you know, as part of one of the motions before the trial, the assistant U.S. attorney said he put forth a motion to prevent the IRP-6 from bringing up anything as to how they conducted business after February 2005. Because of the fact, as we mentioned before, the IRP-6 and the IRP Solutions executives went about conducting business. They were trying to go on and sell the software. They were presenting a solution that was sorely needed by law enforcement all over the nation, thus creating revenue, thus being able to settle up their debts. And we already talked about the fact that when they prevented, you know, them from being able to settle up their debts,
mm-hmm.
it was like a foregone conclusion that, hey, I can present a case now that they never intended to pay their debts.
And to keep them from presenting anything that happened after 2005, after the raid, also prevented the evidence that Assistant U.S. Attorney Matthew Kirsch interfered with commerce. And this is what makes the system so crooked, because he can come in and say, hey, Judge, we want to keep everything out that happened after 2005. As far as what they were doing, conducting business. That keeps him, the fact that his actions breaking the law, get to stay out of the proceedings as well, which you would think that any proper moral judge would say, you know what, we are not going to keep that out. Just because their company got raided, they were under investigation, didn't mean that they didn't continue to try to do business. And that doesn't mean that you get a pass for interfering and keeping them from closing business with several customers by lying and basically having your preconceived notion that an indictment is coming down before a grand jury is indicted. Those are the type of things where you look at Judge Arguello and you say, you are not a judge. You are basically a conspirator in this whole action, because you ensured that U.S. Attorney Matthew Kirsch had everything that he needed to get a false conviction against the IRP-6.
Lisa, what happened on October 7th?
On October 7th, the expert witnesses for the IRP-6, Andrew Alberelli and Kelly Balcom, were both not allowed to testify. Andrew Alberelli was actually taken off the stand after being sworn in. He was removed from the stand, and they would not allow him to testify on behalf of the IRP-6. The AUSA was citing that the U.S. Attorney's Office had not been notified that they would be testifying as industry experts, which is an outright lie.
Well, folks, and Lisa, that's the twist here. I know Cliff had mentioned that earlier, that he wasn't allowed to testify, but the twist here on this timeline, and which makes it false, is that the judge, prior to an expert witness taking the stand in any case or any proceedings, there are hearings behind closed doors with a witness list. And that witness list is submitted to the judge. Number one, he had to be approved by both sides of counsel before he ever walked into that courtroom, because he was subpoenaed to do so. There's the contradiction, and there is the fault in the process, again, that we said, ladies and gentlemen, on this program, doesn't make any sense. So you're not going to have a guy come in, be subpoenaed to appear, and say, oh, and the prosecution comes back and says, oh, we didn't know he was going to be an expert witness. That's completely against the protocol.
And like,
what happened.
Like you said, Lamont, he was on the witness list. And for the assistant U.S. attorney, Matthew Kirsch, to cite that he wasn't on the list to be called as a witness, expert or otherwise, and then for Judge Arguello to grant that, I mean, we just read that back in July of 2011, he sent a letter. So you're talking about three, almost 4 months prior that the U.S. Attorney's Office got the letter. So how do you say, and furthermore, Matthew Kirsch says, well, Judge, he did send this letter. How do you say he didn't notify us, but, oh, by the way, here's what he notified us with?
Folks,
these are the things that make you look at Judge Arguello and say, what type of mental-minded fool are you when you call yourself a judge and you're saying that you're going after justice?
Well, look, anybody that has gone to law school, and there's probably plenty of attorneys that tune into this program, folks, at the, you know, you may be around the kitchen table scratching your head saying, is this HBO? Is this Showtime? What is going on here? Because, ladies and gentlemen, this doesn't stand the reason of what we believed justice to be. This is insane. It says on October 11th and 12th, Judge Arguello makes several comments during proceedings pressuring the IRP executives and consequently compelling one of them to take the stand. What happens there? She violates the Fifth Amendment right. You cannot compel a witness to testify. I didn't go to law school. I think I learned that in American history in junior high school. You can't compel a witness to testify. And the following are comments made by Judge Well. We'll run down very quickly. She makes the statement, if you don't have a witness, I'm going to consider the defendants to have rested their case. Perception.
Absolutely.
If you're saying the defendants have rested their case,
if she never said another word, that right there
is violation of the law.
That's right.
What does she say next? I'm telling you right now, if you don't have a witness to go forward, I will consider you have rested your case. Again, violation number two of the Fifth Amendment right of the IRP 6. And if you, ladies and gentlemen, if you're wondering what's going on here, Sam, what happened here, correct me if I'm wrong, is that the prosecution closed their case earlier than the anticipated time that these witnesses were to appear.
About a week and a half early.
Okay, so what happens now? Something outside of the control of these executives. Now you want to punish them and tell them you want me to create something that doesn't exist, ma'am. They're miles away. There's not a plane ticket going to get them here quick enough to accommodate your request.
Exactly, because you have the prosecutor, Matthew Kirsch, who ends his case early, and then you say, okay, the people who are coming to testify for the defense, you're talking about people coming from Washington, D.C., from Department of Homeland Security, from the Department of Justice, from DHS, from DOJ, from ICE, from the FBI nationally. These are people who have had to lay out their schedule to take time off work, to have to get plane, travel arrangements, to have to get accommodations for staying in a hotel. You don't just say, okay, tomorrow I want them here. Well, guess what? I already had to lay that out with my scheduling and traveling department that I'm going to be gone such and such a day. I'm going to be staying at this hotel, and I'm going to be taking this flight. You don't change that at a moment's notice, and you cannot penalize the defense for what the prosecutor did by saying, this is going to take me this amount of time, so you guys can have your witnesses prepared to testify now. But guess what? Now I'm going to cut it in half and then blame you. And the judge stands for it and begins to reprimand the defense.
Well, this is unreasonable. Lisa, what
absolutely
does the judge say?
She tells them, I told you to have witnesses here, so you better get them here. Call your next witness.
They're not in town, Judge. They're not in town.
She says again, so your witnesses, you better get them here. Then again, she says, no, we're not waiting. I told you to have your witnesses here ready to testify, and if you don't have them, I will not continue.
Wow. You're telling me if you don't have folks from the East Coast here within the next 2 minutes, I am not going to continue. I am not going to give these men due process.
Yeah, and then she says, so call them and tell them they better be here this afternoon.
I'm 2,000 miles away. How
folks,
do I get there? I'm on a jet plane traveling Mach 6.
Let me take a deep breath again. Sam, as you hear this, man, this is several occasions, several comments that make, guess what, absolutely no common sense.
Well, it's a situation where the IRP-6 were being backed into a corner, not by the prosecution.
Right.
They were being backed into a corner by a judge.
By the referee?
Who was supposed to be ensuring that, the playing field was equal.
And, Sam, how can anybody say that the IRP-6 defendant did not feel pressured,
right,
and, or compelled?
Now, look at what she said then. Then she says, now, this right here, if she had only made this statement, this is compelling somebody to be on the stand. I expect a full day of testimony today. I don't care how you do it. We will get a full day of testimony. So you're basically saying, I don't care what happens. If we don't get this full day of testimony, I'm going to rest your case for you. And close. Then you know the prosecutor has the advantage over you. So I don't care. One of you are getting on the stand.
This is in front of the jury.
Well, this is at the sidebar, right? Or some of these comments were
Most
made.
Of these comments
yeah.
were,
these
made,
comments
in
were made in open court. Yeah.
How do you make a comment, ladies and gentlemen of America, law students everywhere across the USA, judges that may be tuning into this program? Look, this is clear and present abuse of power. I am sitting here. I've read this 1,000 times, Sam, and right now I'm flabbergasted again.
Well, this is the script for an HBO movie. Right here.
Well, you know, the IRP-6, they were savvy as far as and anyone looking at this case, they say, okay, for a group of pro se defendants, they did an excellent job of being on top of things when you recognize the fact that, okay, our constitutional right has been violated here.
Clearly.
So then they make a request to the judge, that sidebar where you forced us to take the stand, we want that transcript. What happened? What do you think happened with that request, Lamont?
Denied.
Why?
Denied. And why would you deny that? Because you know what? It's kind of like somebody has made a huge mess, and now there's no way to get around it. It's here. The judge is in a position, so much has been tolerated and allowed, and her participation in the process of injustice, it's too big. There's nothing she can do. All she can do is deny. Deny. Why? Because she's done. It's clear she's broken the law here. What happened?
And she had a dialogue with the court reporter, Darlene Martinez, as to questioning, okay, this transcript that the defendants are asking about, what are we looking at here? You know, how long is it going to take you to pull that together? How much is it going to cost? How many pages are we talking about? Cliff, what did she come back with?
She came back with the fact that, okay, I don't see any reason that you need this portion of the transcript, and I'm not going to get any rush to send it to you.
Well, I'll tell you this right now: retired federal judge H. Lee Sarakin had something to say about this.
I think an appellate court would do one of two things: they'd either order that the transcript be produced, or they'd have to reverse. You know, it would baffles me as to why anyone would deny that motion. It's inconceivable to me that a judge would say, no, you can't have the record of this trial.
Well, I'll tell you what. That statement is made for one reason. He said it's inconceivable.
Inconceivable.
That the higher court, on these actions, and again, that takes us a little bit a step further, but it deals with the fact, during this process, when the judge is doing what she's doing, and she is denying transcripts to be provided when she violated the rights of these men, this is unbelievable.
Well, and you know, Lamont, the grilling at the hands of the judge did not stop during that time, you know, when the comments were being made about you better have somebody, you better do this, and you better do that. It continues with her questioning and making the defense go through their entire plan, basically lay out your strategy right here in front of me and in front of the prosecution. Who do you have scheduled, and when do you have them coming?
And you know what message it's saying, Sam, which is disgraceful. The jury is sitting in the box thinking, if the judge is yelling, we said this before, the judge sets the tone in that courtroom. You are yelling at these men as if they have done something wrong, and the perception by the jury is that these men they have failed. They're doing nothing to put on the defense. You have now molded the mind of the juror to believe in the guilt.
and the incompetence of the defendants. How can they possibly expect fairness?
Well, the judge made the IRP 6 go through their list and then explain, why do you think that this person's testimony is going to be relevant to this case? I mean, if you are a poker player, you may as well just lay your hand wide open to the people that you're playing with, because the judge is making you show your hand. You're not able to put together a strategy that's going to surprise anybody. There is no surprise.
The questions are on this program is that this is the road of injustice that started from the beginning here. Ladies and gentlemen, look at what we have gone through in brief tonight. It gets bigger. Lisa, what happens next?
Well, there was a discrepancy regarding whether or not one of the defense witnesses, Gary Hilberry, who was one of the retired federal agents that was working with IRP, had been properly served. And the assistant U.S. attorney, Kirsch, said that Mr. Hilberry had contacted the U.S. attorney's office, which is highly unusual. And then the IRP executive explained that Mr. Hilberry had been properly served and understood that he was supposed to appear in court. Well, the judge jumps on the IRP executives for the confusion, as if they've done something wrong, because Matt Kirsch was saying one thing, they were saying another.
The jury, Lisa, is trusting, whether we believe it or not, they're trusting what the judge is saying.
Absolutely.
As accurate.
Mm-hmm.
So if the judge is biased against these six men, and she sets that tone, what do you think is going to happen? The jurors will follow exactly what the judge does. This is why it is critical in proceedings that fairness be done and due process be carried out. And Lisa, Sam Cliff, at this point where we have gotten, I'm overwhelmed with the lack of justice that we see here to this point. And we've gone through, Lisa, as you go down here, we've gone through the transcripts, what's happened here. She denied the transcripts, over 200 pages. A lawsuit was filed against Darlene Martinez, who stated she would provide those transcripts. She has failed to do so. Violation of the Court Reporters Act of the Constitution. Violation after violation after violation of the law. And how can anyone sit up and say due process and a fair trial was given? Lisa, if you can go with me to, and if you can share with our listeners down, I think we talked about the admonishment of the IRP6 executives.
Yes,
because witnesses were traveling. But it states here, the IRP6 on October 18th, 2011, executives stated for the record that they want to preserve all records, including all bench conferences. And Judge Aguel states that all records are preserved. But then she begins to admonish, as you said, the IRP6 regarding witnesses being ready. Well, one thing she did wrong, Ms. Sam, she said all records were preserved. Then how then does Darlene Martinez come back and say the records have been destroyed?
Yeah.
Exactly.
Intriguing.
That just makes you go silent.
Yeah, it does.
Unbelievable.
Because you realize that not only, I mean, sure, you have a prosecutor. Of course he's trying his best to convict somebody. I mean, they lie about their seeking justice. They're, for the most part, let's give the 1% that are seeking justice, give them their due course. But they say they're seeking justice, they're really going after conviction. The court reporter, she's got her own agenda. But a judge who has been sworn to uphold justice, to ensure that everything is done properly and that a defendant is given a fair trial and that that due process is preserved in every time it's presented before her court, before her bench. This is a judge, and Judge Christine Arguello is a slap in the face to the robe that she wears that says, I am justice.
Lisa, and tragically, this process brought us to what end?
Well, Lamont, on October 20th, 2011, the jury comes back with a guilty verdict. Our dear friend Judge Arguello revokes the PR bonds that the guys were on, the personal recognizance bonds, and orders the defendants to be taken into custody immediately by federal marshals. And she notifies the magistrate judge Boyd Bolin of the conviction and inquires if the bond hearing can be held. Judge Arguello also tells him that she's concerned that these defendants are a flight risk, and she's recommending that they not be granted bond. They do end up getting their hearing later on, get their bond hearing. And after they've reported to the Denver Detention Center and served approximately 42 days there, they were released on bond at that point.
So, ladies and gentlemen, Sam, as you hear, we're talking about the heartbreak in a courtroom where family members of these six men were present.
Right.
When a verdict is read of guilt. This is what we say, Lisa, Cliff, and Sam, when it comes to regarding the price of injustice. Mothers crying. Wives being torn from their husbands. And chained, and find that they were...
They were shackled and chained. Shackled at their ankles, at their waist, their wrists. They were shackled up and chained up and let out of the courtroom.
So, ladies and gentlemen, you have people, Sam. You're seeing your loved one after a circus of a trial. This is not due process. This is not justice. They're shackled in chains. And we want to say that justice prevailed. There is no justice here.
Lamont, I'm going to borrow a page from the movie Mississippi Burning. And I think that was that movie where the attorney told the folks in the courtroom to close your eyes. So I'm telling our listeners, close your eyes and envision that your loved one is in a courtroom waiting to hear a verdict. And in the meantime, you have armed federal marshals walk into the courtroom, and each one of them has chains and shackles. There are two federal marshals per person. These federal marshals are laughing, joking. They're covering, basically, if you were looking at it, they're covering each entrance and exit to the courtroom. And when the verdict is read, then your loved ones are expected to, they're being stripped of their belts, being stripped of their wallets, being stripped of anything that is just not covering their persons. And they are put in chains behind their backs and on their feet. Now, each one of the IRP six, you know, they looked back and they looked at their loved ones and pretty much said, hey, it's going to be all right. But when you look at this kind of thing, and again, you know, if you can just envision the horrendous sight that unfolds in a situation like this, I had never, ever seen anything like that in my life. And to have them go behind a door, and then you don't see them again for 42 days. So how would you respond to that, you know, if that was your loved one?
Yeah.
How would you handle that? And then to have a federal marshal come back to the waiting room with your loved one's personal belongings in his hands, belt rolled up, wallet, you know, the tie, your jacket, and just balled up in a ball and hand it to you like it's nothing. Just another day at the office.
And that is the tragedy here. Sam, as the emotions flow here tonight, forgive me for mine, because I can see that so vividly in my mind. And all I see here is six patriots who fought to keep America safe.
Yep.
And this is America says, let us say thank you and throw you in a federal prison for trying to keep our children safe. That's uncomprehendable. Lisa, where do we go from here on this order of events? Because the tragedy continues.
Yeah, attorney Gwendolyn Solomon, who had been trying every way she could to get the portion of the transcript that was missing. She went everywhere she could, talked to everyone she could, and got several different stories. I believe Sam said earlier, at one point she was told it was destroyed. Another point she was told that it was at the court reporter's discretion whether or not to release it. They just kept coming back with something different, and we never received that full, that missing part of the transcript where the judge violated this Fifth Amendment right.
And I'm going to skip down, Lisa. On February 9th, 2013, a Just Cause sends letters to U.S. Department of Justice, Office of the Inspector General. Attention to Mr. Michael Horowitz, Senator Michael Bennett in Office of Professional Responsibility, Robin Ashton, head counsel, request investigation of court reporter Darlene Martinez, violation of the Court Reporters Act, the Fifth Amendment violation, sidebar, conference transcripts not being released, and the mishandling of the case in general. A Just Cause went to, and the IRP6 went to a point to seek justice.
Yes.
We're saying these are... IRP6, a Just Cause, has gone to every place that we were told to go.
Yep.
Every place. There's not a place in Washington that probably doesn't know who a Just Cause and IRP6 are.
And I think, you know, Mont, that is the part. This entire story is very, very sad, very touching. But the thing that gets you is we were told by several people, this is who you need to go to. This is who you need to, you know, make your petition known to. Go to the Office of the Inspector General. Go to Office of Professional Responsibility. Go to the Chief Judge. Go here. Go there. If you don't get an answer in your district, in your own backyard, go to D.C. Talk to these people. We have gone everywhere. And if we laid out time, it would take too much time to lay out. I think there's more than 30 actual agencies that a Just Cause has gone to and since the time that the IRP6 have been incarcerated. Now, this is not talking about since 2005 when this horrendous story started and the fight began, but since in the last 3 years that they've been incarcerated, the places that we as a Just Cause have been to say, give us an answer, someone at least investigate the court reporter, the judge, the prosecutor, anybody do anything. And you rarely can get any answer from any of these agencies.
Well, but you guys are making a lot of progress on Capitol Hill right now, you know, with the visits. And I know that there are the offices that you're visiting as far as congressmen, senators. And when you lay this story out there and you start talking about the answer to the ISIS crisis is sitting in prison and then just... even the thing I think we put in the press release today where you talk about the Ways and Means Committee, mm-hmm. where, you know, they looked at the horrendous and the gross injustice with how the church and the pastor was targeted by investigators of the IRS and the FBI and so forth. And when these legislators look at that type of thing and now, you know, as we put more of this timeline out there and people start to see the collective body, so to speak, of all the actions that occurred in this situation, then folks are looking at it and it's like, something's wrong here.
Yeah, and okay. I mean, we have began to get to gain traction. We have begun to, you know, get in touch with people that are starting to understand and see that this is a horrendous set of circumstances and a situation that needs to be taken care of, that needs to be investigated. But it comes at a very high price. I mean, as far as a Just Cause, I mean, we've all but become a lobbyist on Capitol Hill. What it makes you think of is the people who don't have someone out there to be their voice. The people who don't have someone that says, you know what, I'll jump on a plane if you're getting abused in the prison. I'll jump on a plane if no one's fighting for your cause, and I'll be a voice for you. For those that don't have that, that's the sad part. And that's what a Just Cause is about, is trying to help those that don't have a voice.
Well, ladies and gentlemen of America, we have done very little justice to expose this story that has my mind and those here at AJC Radio team in a place of cobwebs trying to find our way through a maze. But there are people responsible for these acts of horror. Lisa, they are called the perpetrators of justice. As we close this program tonight, list them off for the people, would you?
We've got U.S. Attorney John Walsh. We've got Assistant U.S. Attorney Matthew Kirsch. Assistant U.S. Attorney Sunita Hazra, Attorney Greg Holberg, Judge Christine Arguello, Judge Jerome Holmes, Judge Bobby Baldock, Judge Harris Hart, Judge Jackson, Judge Schaefer. We've got Ms. Darlene Martinez, Agent John Smith, Agent Robert Moen, former Agent John Epps, former Agent Gary Hilberry. We've got Attorney Thomas Goodread, Attorney Clifford Barnard, Attorney Thomas Richard, Attorney Robert Berger, Attorney Mitchell Baker, Attorney Boston Stanton Jr., Attorney Rick Kornfeld, Attorney Mark Garagos, and Susan Holland.
Wow. Well, that's a list of perpetrators, folks. Sam, as we close out the program, let's do the rundown.
Yeah, you can join us each week right here on AJC Radio, where we bring the message of justice around the world. For archives of our program, go to AJCRadio.com. Also, you can go to Live365.com for 24/7 AJC programming. And then for each Sunday morning at 10:30 a.m. Eastern Time, you can catch us on the Progressive Radio Network at PRN.FM. And then for on-demand programming, the 405radio.com, as well as iTunes. Lisa.
Yeah, so we would like, we'd like you to, if you have the ability, if you have internet, smartphone, whatever you have, a computer, however you're able to get to the internet, go out to GoFundMe.com. Do a search on IRP6. You'll find a link out there where you can make a donation directly to the IRP6 families that have been affected by this tragedy of injustice.
Cliff.
All righty. I want to say thank you to everybody in the chat room. All of your questions and comments are very much appreciated. I want to say thank you to everybody who helps us out. I mean, I wasn't here for the last few shows. I was out on assignment, but I want to give you all a heartfelt appreciation. That goes out to our production team, Captain Kyle and Dustin Jackson of K&D Productions, helping out Ill Skillet Girl and our interns, Honeycomb Kids, helping out in the back room. We also got our production support team. They are the ones who give us accurate and up-to-date information so that we can pass that along to you. And we really appreciate it. And to the truth, we know you're out there. We appreciate you.
Okay, folks, and, as we get ready to close out another program, Sam, Lisa, Cliff, I tell you what, I'm overwhelmed tonight and convinced that Justice and Lady Justice has gone missing as we wrap up the time and the kids are put to bed. And probably old dog Duke is put back out in the backyard, keep some water in his bowl so he doesn't get too hot out there on the East Coast in Hewitt, and keep the family safe. But don't eat too much barbecue or potato salad. Can cause a little bit of problems if you do a little bit too much of that. So, folks.
Gastro and distress there, buddy.
Yeah, folks. And, again, we appreciate all the listeners out there. Here's David Banks, one of the IRP6 warriors fighting for justice as we say goodnight. From AJC Radio.
Towards trial, but the email communications don't lie. What they told us, it's just implausible that they were not vigorously interested in the software. And one final, another point of that, at the end of 2004, around November 2004, we were called back to D.C., where the Department of Homeland Security coordinated a meeting with the Department of Justice, and numerous agencies attended. FBI, Secret Service, Immigration and Customs, Border Patrol, U.S. Marshals, all these people were there. And at the end of that meeting, the gentleman, Stephen Cooper from the Department of Homeland Security, told us that the FBI liked your software.